Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert A. Heinlein continued. Cassette 5, Side 2.
Where's dinner? Which one of you wenches was supposed to cook tonight? Gad, this household is falling to rack and ruin.
It was my turn tonight, Jill answered. But
excuses, always excuses.
Boss, Anne interrupted sharply, how do you expect anyone to cook when you've kept us penned up all afternoon?
That's the moose's problem, Jubal said dourly. If Armageddon is held on these premises, I expect meals hot and on time right up to the final trump. Furthermore,
Anne completed, it is only 7:40 and plenty of time to have dinner by 8, so quit yelping, crybaby.
Only 20 minutes of 8? Seems like a week since lunch. You haven't left a civilized amount of time for a pre-dinner drink.
Poor you.
Somebody give me a drink. Get everybody a drink. Let's skip dinner. I feel like getting as tight as a tent rope in the rain. And how are we fixed for smorgasbord?
Plenty.
Why not thaw out 18 or 19 kinds and let everybody eat when it feels like it? What's all the argument?
Right away, agreed Jill. Anne stopped to kiss him on his bald spot. Boss, you've done nobly. We'll feed you and get you drunk and put you to bed. Wait, Jill, I'll help.
I'm made to help, too, Smith said eagerly.
Sure, Mike, you can carry trays. Boss, dinner will be by the pool. It's a hot night.
How else?
When they left, Jubal said to Duke,
where the hell have you been?
Thinking.
Doesn't pay. Makes you discontented. Any results?
Yes, said Duke. I've decided that what Mike eats is his business.
Congratulations. A desire not to butt into other people's business is 80% of all human wisdom.
You butt into other people's business.
Who said I was wise?
Jubal, if I offered Mike a glass of water, would he go through that lodge routine?
I think he would.
Duke, the only human characteristic Mike has is an overwhelming desire to be liked. But I want to make sure you know how serious it is. I accepted Water Brotherhood with Mike before I understood it, and I've become deeply entangled with its responsibilities. You'll be committing yourself never to lie to him, never to mislead him, to stick by him come what may. Better think about it.
I have been thinking about it. Jubal, there's something about Mike that makes you want to care for him.
I know. You've probably never encountered honesty before. Innocence. Mike has never tasted the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, so we don't understand what makes him tick. Well, I hope you never regret it.
Jubal looked up.
I thought you had stopped to distill the stuff.
Larry answered. Couldn't find a corkscrew.
Machinery again. Duke, you'll find glasses behind the Anatomy of Melancholy up there.
I know where you hide them.
And we'll have a quick one before we get down to serious drinking.
Duke got glasses. Jubal poured and raised his own.
Here's to alcoholic brotherhood. More suited to the frail human soul than any other sort.
Health.
Cheers.
Jubal poured his down his throat.
Ah,
he said happily, and belched.
Offer some to Mike, Duke, and let him learn how good it is to be human.
Makes me feel creative. Front.
Why are those girls never around when I need them? Front.
I'm front, Miriam answered at the door.
But I was saying, to what strange bittersweet fate my tomboy ambition.
I finished that story while you were chatting with the Secretary General.
Then you are no longer front. Send it off.
Don't you want to read it? Anyhow, I've got to revise it. Kissing Mike gave me new insight. Jubal shuddered.
Read it? Good God, it's bad enough to write such a thing. And don't consider revising, certainly not to fit the facts. My child, a true confession story should never be tarnished by any taint of truth.
Okay, boss. Anne says to come to the pool and have a bite before you eat.
Can't think of a better time. Shall we adjourn, gentlemen?
The party progressed liquidly, with bits of fish and other Scandinavian comestibles added to taste. At Jubal's invitation, Mike tried brandy. Mike found the result disquieting, so he analyzed his trouble, added oxygen to ethanol in an inner process of reverse fermentation, and converted it to glucose and water. Jubal had been observing the effect of liquor on the man from Mars, saw him become drunk, saw him sober up even more quickly. In an attempt to understand, Jubal urged more brandy on Mike, which he accepted since his water brother offered it. Mike sopped up an extravagant quantity before Jubal conceded that it was impossible to get him drunk. Such was not the case with Jubal, despite years of pickling. Staying sociable with Mike during the experiment dulled his wits, So when he asked Mike what he had done, Mike thought that he was inquiring about the raid by the SS, concerning which Mike felt latent guilt. He tried to explain, and, if needed, received Jubal's pardon. Jubal interrupted when he realized what the boy was talking about.
Son, I don't want to know. You did what was needed, just perfect. But,
he blinked owlishly,
don't tell me. Don't ever tell anybody.
Not.
Damnedest thing I've seen since my uncle with two heads debated free silver and refuted himself. An explanation would spoil it.
I do not grok.
Nor I, so let's have another drink.
Reporters started arriving. Jubal received them with courtesy, invited them to eat, drink, and relax, but refrained from badgering himself or the man from Mars. Those who failed to heed were tossed into the pool. Jubal kept Larry and Duke at flank to administer baptism. While some became angry, others added themselves to the dousing squad with the fanatic enthusiasm of proselytes. Jubal had to stop them from ducking the doyen Lipman of the New York Times a third time. Late in the evening, Dorcas sought out Jubal and whispered,
Telephone, boss.
Take a message.
You must answer, boss.
I'll answer it with an axe. I've been intending to get rid of that Iron Maiden, and I'm in the mood. Duke, get me an axe.
Boss, it's the man you spoke to for a long time this afternoon.
Oh. Why didn't you say so?
Jubal lumbered upstairs, bolted his door, went to the phone. Another of Douglas's acolytes was on screen, but was replaced by Douglas.
It took you long enough to answer your phone.
It's my phone, Mr. Secretary. Sometimes I don't answer it at all.
So it seems. Why didn't you tell me Caxton is an alcoholic?
Is he?
He certainly is. He's been on a bender. He was sleeping it off in a flea bag in Sonora.
I'm glad to hear he's been found. Thank you, sir.
He's been picked up for vagrancy. The charge won't be pressed. We are releasing him to you.
I'm in your debt, sir.
Oh, it's not entirely a favor. I'm having him delivered as he was found, filthy, unshaven, and I understand smelling like a brewery. I want you to see what a tramp he is.
Very well, sir. When may I expect him?
A courier left Nogales some time ago. At Mach 4, it should be overhead soon. The pilot will deliver him and get a receipt.
He shall have it.
Now, Counselor, I wash my hands of it. I expect you and your client to appear, whether you bring that drunken libeler or not.
Agreed. When?
Tomorrow at 10.
'Twere best done quickly. Agreed.
Jubal went downstairs and outside.
Jill!
Come here, child.
Yes, Jubal.
She trotted toward him, a reporter with her. Jubal waved him back.
Private,
he said firmly.
Family matter.
Whose family?
A death in yours. Scat!
The newsman grinned and left. Jubal leaned over and said softly,
He's safe.
Ben?
Yes, he'll be here soon.
Oh, Jubal!
She started to bawl. He took her shoulders.
Stop it. Go inside until you get control.
Yes, boss.
Go cry on your pillow, then wash your face.
He went out to the pool.
Quiet, everybody. I have an announcement. We've enjoyed having you, but the party is over.
Boo!
Toss him in the pool. I'm an old man and need my rest, and so does my family. Do cork those bottles. Girls, clear the food away.
There was grumbling. The more responsible quieted their colleagues. In 10 minutes they were gone. In 20 minutes Caxton arrived. The SS officer commanding the car accepted Harshaw's signature in print on a prepared receipt, left while Jill sobbed on Ben's shoulder. Jubal looked him over.
Ben, I hear you've been drunk for a week.
Ben cursed while continuing to pat Jill's back.
Drunk, all right, but haven't had a drink.
What happened?
I don't know.
An hour later, Ben's stomach had been pumped. Jubal had given him shots to offset alcohol and barbiturates. He was bathed, shaved, dressed in borrowed clothes, had met the man from Mars, and was sketchily brought up to date while ingesting milk and food. But he was unable to bring them up to date. For Ben, the week had not happened. He had become unconscious in Washington, had been shaken into wakefulness in Mexico.
Of course I know what happened. They kept me doped in a dark room and wrung me out. But I can't prove anything. There's the village jefe and the madman of this dive. Plus, I'm sure other witnesses to swear how this gringo spent his time, and there's nothing I can do about it.
Then don't,
Jubal advised.
Relax and be happy.
The hell I will. I'll get that
tut-tut, Ben, you're alive, which I would have given long odds against. And Douglas is going to do exactly what we want him to, and like it.
I want to talk about that. I think
you're going to bed with a glass of warm milk to conceal old Doc Harshaw's secret ingredient for secret drinkers.
Soon Caxton was snoring. Jubal was heading for bed and encountered Anne in the upper hall. He shook his head tiredly.
Quite a day, lass.
Yes. I wouldn't have missed it and don't want to repeat it. Go to bed, boss.
In a moment. Anne, what's so special about the way that lad kisses?
Anne looked dreamy, then dimpled. You should have tried it.
I'm too old to change. But I'm interested in everything about the boy. Is this something different?
Anne pondered it. Yes.
How?
Mike gives a kiss his whole attention.
Oh, rats, I do myself. Or did.
Anne shook her head. No, I've been kissed by men who did a very good job, but they don't give kissing their whole attention. They can't. No matter how hard they try, parts of their minds are on something else. Missing the last bus, or their chances of making the gal, or their own techniques in kissing, or maybe worry about jobs or money, or will husband or papa or the neighbors catch on. Mike doesn't have technique, but when Mike kisses you, he isn't doing anything else. You're his whole universe, and the moment is eternal because he doesn't have any plans and isn't going anywhere. Just kissing you. She shivered. It's overwhelming. Don't hmm at me, you old lecher. You don't understand.
No. I'm sorry to say I never will. Well, good night. And by the way, I told Mike to bolt his door.
She made a face at him.
Spoil sport.
He's learning fast enough. Mustn't rush him.
Chapter 18. The conference was postponed 24 hours, which gave Caxton time to recuperate, to hear about his missing week, and to grow closer with the man from Mars. For Mike grokked that Jill and Ben were water brothers, consulted Jill, and solemnly offered water to Ben. Ben had been briefed by Jill. It caused him much soul-searching. Ben was bothered by an uneasy feeling. He felt irked at the closeness between Mike and Jill. His bachelor attitudes had been changed by a week of undead oblivion. He proposed to Jill again as soon as he got her alone. Jill looked away. Please, Ben.
Why not? I've got a steady job. I'm in good health. Or will be as soon as I get their truth drugs out of my system. And since I haven't, I feel a compulsion to tell the truth. I love you. I want to marry you and rub your poor, tired feet. Am I too old? Or are you planning to marry somebody else?
No, neither one. Dear Ben. Ben, I love you. But don't ask me this now. I have responsibilities.
He could not budge her.
He finally realized that the man from Mars wasn't a rival. He was Jill's patient. And a man who marries a nurse must accept the fact that nurses feel maternal toward their charges. Accept it and like it. For if Jillian had not had the character that made her a nurse, he would not love her. It was not the figure eight in which her pert fanny moved when she walked, nor the lush view from the other direction. He was not the infantile type interested solely in the size of mammary glands. No, it was herself he loved. Since what she was would make it necessary for him to take second place to patients who needed her, then he was bloody be damned not going to be jealous. Mike was a nice kid, as innocent and guileless as Jill had described him. And he wasn't offering Jill a bed of roses. The wife of a newspaper man had things to put up with. He might be gone for weeks at a time, and his hours were always irregular. He wouldn't like it if Jill bitched. But Jill wouldn't. Having reached this summing up, Ben accepted water from Mike wholeheartedly. Jubal needed the extra day to plan.
Ben, when you dumped this in my lap, I told Jillian that I would not lift a finger to get this boy his so-called rights. I've changed my mind. We're not going to let the government have the swag. Certainly not this administration, nor any. The next will be worse. Ben, you undervalue Joe Douglas. He's a cheap politician with morals to match. Yes, and ignorant to six decimal places. but he is also a fairly conscientious world chief, better than we deserve. I would enjoy poker with him. He wouldn't cheat, and he would pay up with a smile. Oh, he's an SOB, but that reads swell old boy, too. He's middling decent. Jubal, I'm damned if I understand you. You told me that you'd been fairly certain that Douglas had had me killed. And it wasn't far from it. You juggled eggs to get me out alive, and God knows I'm grateful, but do you expect me to forget that Douglas was behind it? It's none of his doing that I'm alive. He would rather see me dead.
I suppose he would.
But, yep, just that. Forget it. I'm damned if I will.
You'd be silly not to. You can't prove anything. And there's no call to be grateful to me, and I won't let you lay this burden on me. I didn't do it for you.
Huh?
I did it for a little girl who was about to go charging out and maybe get herself killed. I did it because she was my guest, and I stood in loco parentis. I did it because she was all guts and gallantry, but too ignorant a monkey with such a buzzsaw. But you, my cynical and sin-stained chum, know all about buzzsaws. If your carelessness causes you to back into one, who am I to tamper with your karma?
Okay, Jubal, you can go to hell. For monkeying with my karma. If I have one.
A moot point. The predestinationers and free willers were tied in the fourth quarter, last I heard. Either way, I have no wish to disturb a man sleeping in a gutter. Do-gooding is like treating hemophilia. The real cure is to let hemophiliacs bleed to death before they breed more hemophiliacs.
You could sterilize them.
You would have me play God? But we're off the subject.
Douglas didn't try to have you assassinated.
Says who? Says the infallible Jubal Harshaw, speaking ex cathedra from his belly button.
Son, if your deputy sheriff beats a prisoner to death, it's sweepstakes odds that the county commissioners wouldn't have permitted it had they known. At worst, they shut their eyes afterwards, rather than upset apple carts. Assassination has never been a policy in this country.
I'll show you backgrounds of a number of deaths I've looked into.
Jubal waved it aside.
I said it wasn't a policy. We've always had assassination, from prominent ones like Huey Long to men beaten to death with hardly a page 8 story. But it's never been a policy. And the reason you are alive is that it is not Joe Douglas's policy. They snatched you clean, they squeezed you dry, and they could have disposed of you as quietly as flushing a dead mouse down a toilet. But their boss doesn't like them to play that rough, and if he became convinced that they had, it would cost their jobs, if not their necks.
Jubal paused for a swig.
Those thugs are just a tool. They aren't a Praetorian guard that picks the Caesar.
So whom do you want for Caesar? Courthouse Joe, whose indoctrination goes back to when this country was a nation and not a satrapy in a polyglot empire. Douglas, who can't stomach assassination.
Or do you want to toss him out?
We can, just by double-crossing him. Toss him out and put in a secretary general from a land where life is cheap and assassination a tradition.
If you do, Ben, what happens to the next Snoopy newspaper man who walks down a dark alley?
Caxton didn't answer.
As I said, the SS is just a tool. Men are always for hire who like dirty work. How dirty will that work become if you nudge Douglas out of his majority?
Jubal, are you saying I ought not to criticize the administration?
Nope. Gadflies are necessary. But it's well to look at the new rascals before you turn your present rascals out. Democracy is a poor system. The only thing that can be said for it is that it's 8 times as good as any other method. Its worst fault is that its leaders reflect their constituents, a low level. But what can you expect? So look at Douglas and ponder that, in his ignorance, stupidity, and self-seeking, he resembles his fellow Americans, but is a notch or two above average. Then look at the man who will replace him if his government topples. There's a little difference. There's always a difference. This is between bad and worse, which is much sharper than that between good and better.
Well, what do you want me to do?
Nothing, Harshaw answered. I'll run this show myself. I expect you to refrain from chewing out Joe Douglas over this coming settlement. Maybe praise him for statesmanlike restraint. You're making me vomit. Use your hat. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do. The first principle in riding a tiger is to hang on tight to its ears.
Quit being pompous. What's the deal?
Quit being obtuse and listen. Mike has the misfortune to be heir to more wealth than Croesus dreamed of.
plus a claim to political power under a politico-judicial precedent unparalleled in jugheadedness since Secretary Fall was convicted of receiving a bribe that Doheny was acquitted of paying. I have no interest in true prince nonsense, nor do I regard that wealth as his. He didn't produce it. Even if he had earned it, property is not the natural and obvious concept that most people think it is. Come again? Ownership is a sophisticated abstraction, a mystical relationship. God knows our legal theorists make this mystery complicated. But I didn't dream how subtle it was until I got the Martian slant. Martians don't own anything, not even their bodies. Wait a minute, Jubal. Even animals have property, and the Martians aren't animals. They're a civilization with cities and all sorts of things. Yes, foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests. Nobody understands Mia set to us better than a watchdog. But not Martians, unless you regard joint ownership of everything by millions or billions of senior citizens, ghosts, to you, my friend, as property. Say, Jubal, how about these old ones? You want the official version? No. Your opinion. I think it is pious poppycock, suitable for enriching lawns. Superstition burned into the boy's brain so early that he stands no chance of breaking loose. Jill talks as if she believed it. You will hear me talk as if I did, too. Ordinary politeness. One of my most valued friends believes in astrology. I would never offend her by telling her what I think. The capacity of humans to believe in what seems to me highly improbable, from table-tapping to the superiority of their children, has never been plumbed. Faith strikes me as intellectual laziness. But Mike's faith in his old ones is no more irrational than a conviction that the dynamics of the universe can be set aside through prayers for rain. Jubal, I confess to a suspicion that immortality is a fact. But I'm glad my grandfather's ghost doesn't boss me. He was a cranky old devil.
And so was mine. And so am I. But is there any reason why a citizen's franchise should be voided simply because he is dead? The precinct I was raised in had a large graveyard vote, almost Martian. As may be, our lad Mike can't own anything, because the old ones already own everything. So I have trouble explaining to him that he owns over 1 million shares of Luna Enterprises, plus the Lyle Drive, plus assorted chattels and securities. It doesn't help that the original owners are dead, and that makes them old ones. Mike would never stick his nose into the business of old ones.
Damn it, he's incompetent.
Of course. He can't manage property because he doesn't believe in its mystique, any more than I believe in his ghosts. Ben, all that Mike owns is a toothbrush, and he doesn't know he owns that. If you took it, he would assume that the old ones had authorized the change.
Jubal shrugged.
He is incompetent, so I shan't allow his competency to be tried. For what guardian would be appointed?
Douglas, or one of his stooges.
Are you certain, Ben? Consider the makeup of the High Court. Might not the appointee be named Savonavong, or Nadi, or Key?
You could be right.
In which case the lad might not live long. Or he might live to a ripe age in some pleasant garden, more difficult to escape from than Bethesda Hospital.
What do you plan to do?
The power the boy nominally owns is too dangerous. So we give it away.
How do you give away that much money?
You don't. Giving it away would change the balance of power. Any attempt would cause the boy to be examined on his competence. So instead we let the tiger run like hell while hanging on to its ears for dear life.
Ben, let me outline what I intend to do. Then you do your damnedest to pick holes in it. Not the legality. Douglas's legal staff will write the double talk and I'll check it. I want you to sniff it for political feasibility. Now, here's what we are going to do.
Chapter 19. The Martian diplomatic delegation went to the Executive Palace the next morning. The unpretentious pretender to the Martian throne, Mike Smith, did not worry about the purpose of the trip. He simply enjoyed it. They rode a chartered flying greyhound. Mike sat in the Astrodome, Jill on one side and Dorcas on his other, and stared as the girls pointed out sights and chattered. The seat was intended for two. A warming growing closer resulted. He sat with an arm around each and looked and listened and tried to grok, and could not have been happier if he had been 10 feet underwater. It was his first view of Terran civilization. He had seen nothing in being removed from the champion. He had spent a few minutes in a taxi 10 days earlier, but had grokked none of it.
Since then his world had been bounded by house and pool, garden and grass and trees. He had not been as far as Jubal's gate. But now he was sophisticated. He understood windows, realized that the bubble surrounding him was for looking out of, and that the sights he saw were cities. He picked out, with the help of the girls, where they were on the map flowing across the lapboard. He had not known until recently that humans knew about maps. It had given him a twinge of happy homesickness the first time he had grokked a human map. It was static and dead compared with maps used by his people. But it was a map. Even human maps were Martian in essence. He liked them. He saw almost 200 miles of countryside, most of its sprawling world metropolis, and savored every inch, tried to grok it. He was startled by the size of human cities and their bustling activity, so different from the monastery garden cities of his own people. It seemed to him that a human city must wear out almost at once, so choked with experience that only the strongest old ones could bear to visit its deserted streets and grok in contemplation events and emotions piled layer on endless layer in it. He had visited abandoned cities at home on a few wonderful and dreadful occasions. Then his teachers had stopped it, grokking that he was not strong enough. Questions to Jill and Dorcas enabled him to grok the city's age. It had been founded a little over 2 Earth centuries ago. Since Earth time units had no favor for him, he converted to Martian years and numbers. 3 filled plus 3 waiting years, 3 to the 4th power plus 3 to the 3rd power, equals 108 Martian years. Terrifying and beautiful. Why, these people must be prepared to abandon the city to its thoughts before it shattered under the strain and became not. Yet, by mere time, the city was only an egg. Mike looked forward to returning to Washington in a century or two to walk its empty streets and try to grow close to its endless pain and beauty, grokking thirstily until he was Washington and the city was himself. If he were strong enough by then. He filed the thought, as he must grow and grow and grow before he would be able to praise and cherish the city's mighty anguish. The Greyhound driver swung east in response to a rerouting of unscheduled traffic, caused, unknown to Mike, by Mike's presence. And Mike saw the sea. Jill had to tell him that it was water. Dorcas added that it was the Atlantic Ocean and traced the shoreline on the map. Mike had known since he was a nestling that the planet next nearer the sun was almost covered with the water of life, and lately he had learned that these people accepted this richness casually. He had taken the more difficult hurdle of grokking the Martian orthodoxy that water ceremony did not require water. Water was symbol for essence, beautiful, but not indispensable. But Mike discovered that knowing in abstract was not the same as physical reality. The Atlantic filled him with such awe that Jill said sharply, "Mike, don't you dare!" Mike chopped off his emotion and stored it. Then he stared at water stretching to horizon and tried to measure it until his head was buzzing with threes and powers of threes and superpowers of powers. As they landed on the palace, Jubal called out, "Remember, girls, form a square around him and don't be backward about planting a heel or jabbing an elbow. And you'll be cloaked, but that's no reason not to step on a foot if you're crowded. Or is it?"
"Quit fretting, boss. Nobody crowds a witness. And I'm wearing spike heels and way more than you do."
"Okay, Duke, send Larry back with the bus as soon as possible."
"I grok it, boss."
"Quit jittering." "I'll jitter as I please. Let's go."
Harshaw, the four girls, with Mike and Caxton, got out. The bus took off. The landing flat was not crowded, but it was far from empty. A man stepped forward and said heartily,
"Dr. Harshaw, I'm Tom Bradley, senior executive assistant to the Secretary General. You are to go to Mr. Douglas's office. He will see you before the conference starts." "No."
Bradley blinked.
"I don't think you understood. These are instructions from the Secretary General."
"Oh, he said that it was all right for Mr. Smith to come with you."
"The man from Mars, I mean." "No, we're going to the conference room. Have somebody lead the way. In the meantime, I have an errand for you. Miriam, that letter."
"But Dr. Harshaw..."
"I said, no. You ought to deliver this to Mr. Douglas at once and fetch his receipt to me."
Harshaw signed across the flap of an envelope Miriam handed to him, pressed his thumbprint over the signature, handed it to Bradley.
"Tell him that he must read this at once, before the meeting."
"But the Secretary General desires..."
"The Secretary desires to see that letter."
Young man, I am endowed with second sight. I prophesy that you won't be here tomorrow if you waste time getting it to him.
Bradley said, Jim, take over, and left with the letter. Jubal sighed. He had sweated over that letter. Anne and he had been up most of the night preparing draft after draft. Jubal intended to arrive at an open settlement, but he had no intention of taking Douglas by surprise. A man stepped forward in answer to Bradley's order. Jubal sized him up as one of the clever young men on the make who gravitate to those in power and do their dirty work. The man smiled and said, The name's Jim Sanforth, Doctor. I'm the chief's press secretary. I'll be buffering for you from now on, arranging press interviews and so forth. I'm sorry to say that the conference is not ready. At the last minute, we've had to move to a larger room.
It's my thought that we'll go to that conference room right now.
Doctor, you don't understand. They are stringing wires and things. The room is swarming with reporters and...
Very well. We'll chat with them.
No, Doctor. I have instructions.
Youngster, you can take your instructions, fold them until they're all corners, and shove them in your oubliette. We are here for one purpose, a public conference. If the conference is not ready, we'll see the press in the conference room.
But
you're keeping the man from Mars standing on a windy roof.
Harshaw raised his voice.
Is there anyone smart enough to lead us to this conference room?
Sanforth swallowed and said, Follow me, Doctor. The conference room was alive with newsmen and technicians, but there was a big oval table, chairs, and several smaller tables. Mike was spotted, and Sanforth's protest did not keep the crowd back. Mike's flying wedge of Amazons got him to the big table. Jubal sat him against it with Dorcas and Jill flanking him, and the fair witness and Miriam seated behind him. Then, Jubal made no attempt to fend off questions or pictures. Mike had been told that people would do strange things, and Jubal had warned him to take no sudden actions, such as causing persons or things to go away or stop, unless Jill told him to. Mike took the confusion gravely. Jill was holding his hand, and her touch reassured him. Jubal wanted pictures, the more the better. As for questions, he did not fear them. A week of talking with Mike had convinced him that no reporter could get anything out of Mike without expert help. Mike's habit of answering literally and stopping would nullify attempts to pump him. Most questions Mike answered with,
I do not know,
or
beg pardon.
A Reuters correspondent, anticipating a fight over Mike's status as an heir, tried to sneak in his own test of Mike's competence.
Mr. Smith, what do you know about the laws of inheritance?
Mike knew that he was having trouble grokking the human concept of property, and in particular the ideas of bequest and inheritance. So he stuck to the book, which Jubal recognized as Eli on Inheritance and Bequest, Chapter 1. Mike recited what he had read with precision and no expression for page after page, while the room settled into silence and his interrogator gulped. Jubal let it go on, until every newsman there knew more than he wanted to know about dower and courtesy, consanguinean and uterine, per stirpes and per capita. At last, Jubal said,
That's enough, Mike.
Mike looked puzzled.
There is more.
Later. Does someone have a question on another subject?
A reporter for a London Sunday paper jumped in with one close to his employer's pocketbook.
Mr. Smith, we understand you like girls. Have you ever kissed a girl?
Yes.
Did you like it?
Yes.
How did you like it?
Mike hardly hesitated.
Kissing girls is a goodness, he explained. It beats the hell out of card games.
Their applause frightened him, but he could feel that Jill and Dorcas were not frightened. They were trying to restrain that noisy expression of pleasure which he could not learn, so he calmed his fright and waited. He was saved from further questions and was granted a great joy. He saw a familiar figure entering by a side door.
My brother, Dr. Mahmoud,
Mike went on in overpowering excitement, in Martian. The champion's semantician waved and smiled, answered in the same jarring language while hurrying to Mike. The two continued talking in unhuman symbols, Mike in eager torrent, Mahmoud not as rapidly, with sounds like a rhinoceros ramming a steel shed. The newsmen stood it for some time, those who used sound recording it and writers noting it as color. At last one interrupted.
Dr. Mahmoud, what are you saying?
Mahmoud answered in clipped Oxonian. For the most part I've been saying, slow down, my dear boy. Do, please.
And what does he say?
The rest is personal, private, of no possible interest. Greetings, you know. Old friends.
He continued to chat. In Martian. Mike was telling his brother all that had happened since he had last seen him so that they might grok closer. But Mike's abstraction of what to tell was Martian in concept, it being concerned primarily with New Water Brothers and the flavor of each, the gentle water that was chill, the depth of Anne, the strange, not yet fully grokked fact that Jubal tasted now like an egg, then like an old one, but was neither, the ungrokkable vastness of ocean. Mahmud had less to tell, since less had happened to him by Martian standards. One Dionysian excess, of which he was not proud. One long day spent lying face down in Washington's Suleiman Mosque, the results of which he had not yet grokked and would not discuss. No New Water Brothers. He stopped Mike presently and offered his hand to Jubal. "You're Dr. Harshaw. Valentine Michael thinks he has introduced me, and he has by his rules." Harshaw looked him over as he shook hands. Chap looked like a huntin', shootin', sportin' Britisher from tweedy, expensively casual clothes to clipped gray mustache. But his skin was swarthy, and the genes for that nose came from somewhere near the Levant. Harshaw did not like fakes, and would choose cold corn pone over the most perfect syntho sirloin. But Mike treated him as a friend. So friend he was until proved otherwise. To Mahmud, Harshaw looked like a museum exhibit of what he thought of as a yank, vulgar, dressed too informally for the occasion, loud, probably ignorant, and almost certainly provincial. A professional man, too, which made it worse, as in Dr. Mahmud's experience, American professional men were undereducated and narrow, mere technicians. He held a vast distaste for all things American. Their incredible polytheistic babble of religions, their cooking, their manners, their bastard architecture and sickly arts, and their blind, arrogant belief in their superiority long after their sun had set. Their women most of all, their immodest, assertive women with gaunt, starved bodies, which nevertheless reminded him disturbingly of houris. Four of them crowded around Valentine Michael, at a meeting which should be all male. But Valentine Michael offered these people, including these ubiquitous female creatures, offered them proudly and eagerly as his water brothers, thereby laying on Mahmud an obligation more binding than that owed to the sons of one's father's brother, since Mahmud understood the Martian term for such accretive relationships from observation of Martians, and did not need to translate it inadequately as catenative assemblage, nor even as things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. He had seen Martians at home. He knew their poverty by Earth standards. He had dipped into and had guessed at far more of their cultural wealth, and grokked the supreme value that Martians placed on interpersonal relationships. Well, there was nothing else for it. He had shared water with Valentine Michael, and now he must justify his friend's faith in him. He hoped that these Yanks were not complete bounders. So he smiled warmly. "Yes, Valentine Michael has explained to me, most proudly, that you are all in..." Mahmud used one word of Martian. "To him."
"Nay."
"What a brotherhood. You understand?"
"I grok it."
Mahmud doubted if Harshaw did, but went on smoothly.
"Since I am in that relationship to him, I must ask to be considered a member of the family. I know your name, Doctor, and I have guessed that this must be Mr. Caxton. I have seen your face pictured at the head of your column, Mr. Caxton. But let me see if I have the young lady straight. This must be Anne?"
"Yes, but she's cloaked."
"Yes, of course, I'll pay my respects to her later."
Harshaw introduced him to the others. And Jill startled him by addressing him with the correct honorific for a water brother, pronouncing it three octaves higher than any Martian would talk, but with sore throat purity of accent. It was one of a dozen words she could speak out of 100 odd that she was beginning to understand, but this one she had down pat, because it was used to her and by her many times each day. Dr. Mahmud's eyes widened. Perhaps these people were not mere uncircumcised barbarians. His young friend did have strong intuition. Instantly he offered Jill the correct honorific in response and bowed over her hand. Jill saw that Mike was delighted. She managed to croak the shortest of 9 forms by which a water brother may return the response,
Although she did not grok it, and would not have considered suggesting, in English, the nearest human biological equivalent, certainly not to a man she had just met. Mahmud, who did understand it, took its symbolic meaning rather than its humanly impossible literal meaning, and spoke rightly in response. Jill had passed her limit. She did not understand his answer, and could not reply, even in English. But she got an inspiration. At intervals around the table were water pitchers, each with its clump of glasses. She got a pitcher and tumbler, filled the latter. She looked Mahmud in the eye, said earnestly, "Water, our nest is yours." She touched it to her lips and handed it to Mahmud. He answered in Martian, saw that she did not understand, and translated, "Who shares water, shares all." He took a sip and started to return it, checked himself, and offered Harshaw the glass. Jubal said,
"I can't speak Martian, son, but thanks for water. May you never be thirsty."
He drank a third of it.
"Ah!"
He passed it to Ben. Caxton looked at Mahmud and said soberly,
"Grow closer. With water of life, we grow closer."
He sipped it and passed it to Dorcas. In spite of precedents already set, Dorcas hesitated. "Dr. Mahmud, do you know how serious this is to Mike?"
"I do, miss."
"Well, it's just as serious to us. You understand? You grok?"
"I grok its fullness, or I would have refused to drink."
"All right. May you always drink deep. May our eggs share a nest." Tears started down her cheeks. She drank and passed the glass hastily to Miriam. Miriam whispered, "Pull yourself together, kid," then spoke to Mike. "With water we welcome our brother," then added to Mahmud, "Nest, water, life." She drank. "Our brother." She offered him the glass. Mahmud drank what was left and spoke, but in Arabic. "And if ye mingle your affairs with theirs, then they are your brothers."
"Amen," Jubal agreed.